Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Imagine we've gone back to the bad old days, before anti-discrimination laws, where getting a job might have had more to do with your race than with whether you could actually do the work. Well, workplace discrimination is back, particularly in anything to do with defence technology. And it's now legal across most of Australia to stop someone taking on certain work because of their country of birth.
A long-standing employee who did have access to classified material. He happened to have been born in Vietnam and was in fact adopted by an Australian family. He was educated his whole life in Australia. He was in fact joined the Air Force. He had pretty high security clearances already, and that was one of the reasons why he was actually involved in the job. They actually told him that he was to be removed from the site and proceeded to make him redundant.
Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Lorena Allam. From discrimination on the defence factory floor to treaties with America at the highest level, the way we do defence business is under scrutiny. For the first time in 8 years, there's a major review going on of the Australian government's defence policy for the future. And at the same time, we're asking the United States to agree to a defence trade treaty that will make it easier for Australian companies to turn a profit. In between these high-level negotiations is the issue of Australian citizens not being able to work on American technology because of where they were born, even as you'll hear, if they were born in a plane above Sudan. All of these moves will affect Australia's ability to keep up with our rapidly globalising world.
I think you're going to see a tremendous amount of tension on the requirement in the Defence Trade Treaty that we've just signed, where Australia has to investigate family ties of people that are going to be given access to the more sensitive technologies that we're talking about. How that plays out, I think, is one of the going to be one of the most important political and indeed strategic issues that Australian governments are going to be confronted with.
That's Bob Wiley from the Australian Defence Force Academy, ADFA. There's an important American law called the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, or ITAR. It covers all contracts Americans have with anyone they call a foreigner, and that means anyone who is not American. The devil in the detail of ITAR means that Australia has to investigate the birthplace of any Australian who has a job working on anything to do with American defence technology. Normally, investigating that would be illegal, but anti-discrimination tribunals here have bent the law so defence companies can do just that. In Australia, if you're a citizen, you're Australian, and that's your nationality, even if you were born in another country. If you want to work in defence, nationality is based not on citizenship, but on where you were born. These stark definitions are at the heart of ITAR, the American government's law on who gets to work anywhere near its defence materials. The list of things classified by ITAR as defence technology is very long, everything from gun belts and bullets to submarines and spacecraft, as well as all the extras you need to maintain them. ITAR also lists the countries the US absolutely will not deal with, and it can change that list at any time. At the moment, it includes the following countries:
Afghanistan, Belarus, Burma, China, Cyprus, Cuba, Haiti, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, North Korea, Sri Lanka, Sudan, Venezuela, Vietnam, Yemen, Zimbabwe.
Director of Law Reform and Social Justice at the ANU, Simon Rice.
At the beginning, if you go back to the ITAR, the American regulations, it simply says US and foreign. Then you do get refinements of foreign. The first refinement is national of the importing country. That would be Australia. And then you start to get dual nationals, who are Australians and somebody else, but then beyond the pale altogether are nationals of proscribed countries, and they are the enemy.
And even an Australian citizen can be seen as the enemy if you were born in any of those proscribed countries. And this contradicts our laws about nationality and citizenship, says Simon Rice.
America simply assumes if you were born somewhere, then we treat you as having that nationality. Whether in fact the country you were born treats you as a national, we're not concerned. If you were born in Syria, then we will treat you as Syrian.
Which clearly conflicts with Australian law.
Yes, it does. Because in Australia, we distinguish nationality and national origin, and we don't jump to conclusions that where you were born means you're hostile or an enemy.
Well, ITAR regulations insist that we do. And the anti-discrimination tribunals have agreed that sometimes there can be exemptions to the Australian laws. Many people are unhappy about that, as you'll hear, and it's a tension that's recognised in the US Senate. In order to comply with US law, Australian defence companies have come up with some unusual solutions, like asking employees, from the highest managers to the cleaners, to wear badges.
Perhaps what people don't understand is what that actually means on the factory floor. It means that people's race is being identified. People are being badged. People are walking around wearing their overalls with small badges on them saying, effectively, I am or I am not an Australian.
But we're wearing badges. I've got my badge here that says ABC. What do you mean? Isn't that part of normal security procedure?
I don't think it's part of normal security procedure for people to involuntarily be badged according to their country of birth, to have to proclaim to their workplace where they were born.
Simon Rice from the ANU College of Law.
In the middle of a combat zone, you need the right information at the right time.
When vital decision-making information...
The four big defence companies in Australia are now allowed to hire, fire and redeploy people based on where they were born. The companies are Raytheon, Boeing, Thales and BAE. Here's their promo.
BAE Systems. We live in a world of unprecedented challenges, and it's the armed forces' job to provide security in this new world. They need systems to deliver solutions that allow them to do their jobs effectively and safely, that give them an edge, a tangible advantage. Like partnerships that provide the right solutions for the right people at the right time.
You have cutting-edge technology. The people are great. The leadership is superb.
We are Raytheon.
We are Raytheon.
Customer success.
These companies employ thousands of people and turn over hundreds of millions of dollars in Australia. The companies argue that they can't do business in Australia unless they're given exemptions from our laws on race discrimination. Anti-discrimination tribunals around the country publish their decisions on their websites, and Background Briefing has read through all of those decisions. The reasoning is almost identical, even if the language varies. The Victorian Tribunal says,
"One suspects that ITAR is misconceived, but then I rather doubt that the United States government will back down from ITAR in the face of a decision from the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal. Sometimes you simply cannot ignore the elephant in the room. Like it or not, the United States is the world power."
That's an extract from the Victorian decision. In all five jurisdictions, the tribunals accepted a few major points without question. Unless Australian companies comply with US laws, they face massive fines, possibly millions of dollars. They might be denied access to US technology in the future, crippling their chances of competing in this cutthroat market. Without access to US technology, they'd be unable to complete the work, and then be in breach of their contracts with the Australian government. And they'd have to lay off staff. Before it was bought out by Thales, ADI claimed 40% of its workforce would have to be redeployed or sacked if it didn't get the race discrimination exemption. ADI told the tribunals it had 49 ITAR contracts with the Australian government, worth about $400 million, and losing contracts that lucrative would damage the Australian economy. The companies have got their way in five states so far, but the issue is still up in the air in the ACT and the Northern Territory. Everybody is in a difficult situation, says Simon Rice.
The tribunals are confronted by an impossible choice. and the employers are only there because they're being forced by the export regulations. Nobody would be doing this if, at its source, America was not so dogmatic and inflexible in its demands that the world sees things in terms of US and foreign.
The US would say, though, that they have no choice but to safeguard their own military technology and that foreign nationals are a threat to US security.
I agree that they have to protect their own security and their defence technology. What I find it hard to accept is that they can simply assume that a threat will come from anyone who is not a US citizen. Point blank, draw the line. It defies logic. And there are endless examples. People who were in Iran under the Shah and then migrated to Britain after the overthrow of the Shah would be treated as enemies now because they were born in Iran, although it was then a friendly Iran. Timothy McVeigh was an American. The American regulations don't even ask the kind of American you are. He would be all right. They would be happy to have Timothy McVeigh handle their defence material because he's American. Now, there's a clear illustration of how crude a measure the security steps are.
Simon Rice, law professor at the ANU. The Australian government's taken a very pragmatic view of the situation. America is our powerful ally. We need to stay close to get the best defence technology. And Australia wants the business opportunities. On the phone from Canberra, head of the industry division in the Defence Department, Kerry Clark.
The US after 9/11 made some determinations that they would like to exclude access to their equipment for certain sorts of nations. And we've accepted it, that we would make sure that the people that are dealing with that equipment in Australia comply with the same rules. If you're dealing with classified equipment, then it makes sense that we control access to it. If you've got a highly specialised tank and you're having it serviced, you don't want every man, woman and child running all over it, copying the equipment or, in worst case, fiddling with it in such a way as to make it unserviceable when it's needed for operations.
But America's tough rules have created tensions around the world, and there have been some strange outcomes. For example, in Canada, they've just settled a case involving a man born in Haiti, but who'd been a Canadian citizen for 30 years. Because he was born in Haiti, which is seen as an enemy country, he was denied a job with a helicopter manufacturer. The American regulations assume that no matter what kind of citizenship you have or how long you've lived away from home, your loyalties are always going to be based on your country of birth. Some Canadian companies get around race restrictions by giving their foreign-born but Canadian employees paid leave during the time of work on an ITAR-related contract. Even in the US itself, academics have long complained that ITAR is killing off research, especially research by foreign students, as you'll hear in this reading. In 2000, the Dean of Research at Stanford University, Charles Kruger, wrote a letter to his local senator to complain that it only took one sentence in the ITAR regulations
to ban a Stanford graduate student, who is Chinese, from continuing his work with spacecraft control algorithms. It was enough to prevent the world's expert in proton monitors, who is Irish, from being in the same room as the equipment he designed when American researchers bolted it onto a satellite.
The ITAR regulations were considerably tightened after the 9/11 attacks, and a great many students and researchers not born in America were either deported or severely restricted in their work. Charles Kruger's letter from Stanford University listed a number of other examples, including this one.
A Turkish national graduate student has developed a new hybrid rocket fuel that we are in the process of patenting. United Technologies read the student's work and wanted to fund further testing of the fuel, but insisted that they could not discuss the student's concept with the student unless Stanford obtained a licence under ITAR.
People have been sacked or denied job opportunities in Australia too. Simon Rice.
ITAR says to a company such as Boeing in Australia, if you get our material, then don't let anybody other than Australian or American see it or even be in its presence. You can't have on the factory floor somebody who is of the wrong nationality.
Needless to say, the unions are keeping an eye on all this. In Canberra, two union members were hit hard. They worked at the tracking station at Tidbinbilla, Canberra's deep space communication complex, The station is run by Raytheon. Raytheon is the US defence transnational, famous for its bunker busters and Patriot missiles. Raytheon had two workers at Tidbinbilla who didn't fit ITAR's bill. One has since lost his job. From the peak body, Unions ACT, this is Kim Sattler.
One was a long-standing employee who did have access to classified material. He happened to have been born in Vietnam and was in fact adopted by an Australian family. He was educated his whole life in Australia. He was in fact joined the Air Force. He had pretty high security clearances already, and that was one of the reasons why he was actually involved in the job. They actually applied the ITAR arrangements and told him that he was to be removed from the site and proceeded to make him redundant.
What happened to that employee?
He will probably not work again. He went through terrible stress and trauma through the whole exercise because he had been a long-standing employee, well respected by others out there. There was no issue with his job. It was pure accident of birth.
That man took his case to the Human Rights Commission, but it was settled privately. Background Briefing attempted to contact him, but he didn't want to comment, and neither did his former employer, Raytheon. The second case involved a man whose job is loading materials in and out of the deep space complex at Tidbinbilla. His parents are Greek, but he himself happened to be born in a plane as it flew across the Sudan. According to the way America defines nationality, that meant this man is Sudanese. Kim Sattler.
Now, he continues to work there, but he's now had his job completely changed so that he does not come into contact with particular classified material. So he has to be marked that way.
How is he marked on the job?
By wearing a badge.
Because according to the ITAR regulations, he was born in Sudan.
When in fact he was born in a plane hovering over Sudan.
That's Kim Sattler from Unions ACT.
And when they give their all and give their best, then wow.
In America, the company Raytheon promotes itself this way.
The community views Raytheon as a great corporate citizen, a company that is highly ethical, a company that you can trust.
We care. We care about your success.
And the thing we can't lose sight of is...
Background Briefing contacted all four big defence companies in Australia, Raytheon, Boeing, BAE and Thales. None of them would agree to a formal interview or make a formal statement, but they did confirm some issues. Two company managers who spoke to us said they're only doing what the American government insists on through the ITAR regulations. It's actually not good PR for the companies. And most importantly, it can be expensive to have to go to court or tribunals when issues arise. One company spent $2 million on legal fees just in West Australia to get permission to have exemption from its anti-discrimination laws. And the exemptions cause unnecessary tension in the workplace. From Unions ACT, Kim Sattler.
People out in the workplace are quite concerned about whether they're required to reveal their country of birth.
Well, how many of your members might fall into that category who are working at Tidbinbilla?
We're not entirely sure because we don't generally do an ethnicity check on our membership. We tag one and all, and we don't actually keep those sort of records of country of birth.
Well, you told the ACT Commissioner that you believed it was racial profiling.
It is indeed racial profiling. You couldn't call it anything else where they really have to know exactly the country of birth, and they refuse to recognise that nationality or changes in someone's life now makes them less of a security risk or not a security risk at all because, in fact, they are Australian citizens.
Kim Sattler from Unions ACT. In Victoria, the big American company Boeing was given permission to discriminate on grounds of race a few years ago. Boeing employs thousands of workers, most of whom are covered by the Manufacturing Workers Union, the AMWU. National Secretary Dave Oliver says Boeing promised no workers would lose pay or conditions, but...
There's one example of a dual citizen Iranian who was working in a particular area and was unable to get the clearance that was required. As a result of this, he has been removed from that particular area. but I understand his wages and conditions and status has been maintained, but as a result of this, his career path has basically been a glass ceiling imposed in the area where he now works.
The big Australian companies have to spend a lot of time implementing the ITAR rules and regulations. Whole departments are given over to handling compliance. One manager told Background Briefing it can get so complicated, sometimes even the Americans aren't sure how it works.
In a dark corner of a hamburger joint that has seen better days, your German...
This is part of an online training video designed to help companies meet ITAR's tough export rules.
Something doesn't seem right. You remember your manager saying something about export licenses and maybe foreign nationals. Sounds pretty melodramatic, doesn't it? Don't worry, I'm here to help. I'm Blanca, Max Blanca, compliance detective.
That's Max, the training video detective, talking about compliance with ITAR, the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, America's laws about who can and can't access its defence technology.
Here's an example. A scenario might feature a situation involving the hiring of a foreign national. The action that may be required based on this situation is that the human resources and the hiring manager may be required to consult with the export control department so they can ensure the proper license or other export authority is in place.
Max Blanca, compliance detective. The reality is that defence is a ruthless business and the Americans dominate. If their rules are too tough, then it's too bad. From the ANU, Hugh White.
I don't want to make the US out to sound too heartless in this. Individual US officials, I'm sure, would shake their head and say, yes, that's a very difficult problem for you. And it is a problem for us. I think it's unlikely that the United States is going to compromise much on that sort of thing.
And so presumably we have to play by the US rules in accessing that defence technology.
Well, that's right. The United States is in a very good competitive position, and actually for two reasons. The first is that United States defence companies don't really depend on exports for the viability of their business. The overwhelming demand for US-built defence equipment is the US Armed Forces. So it's not an imperative for the US to sell to others. It's icing on the cake. That means that there's not a great loss to the United States if the kind of constraints that they attempt to put on defence exports through processes like the ITARs drive some buyers away. If the United States system puts requirements on us, we've got very little choice but to comply.
Hugh White. So far, Tasmania is the only state that hasn't given the companies a race discrimination exemption because the companies haven't applied there. But in the territories, the battle is far from over. Last November, the ACT's Human Rights Commission turned Raytheon down in its attempt to be given permission to discriminate. But the company went to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal and won. This week, the Human Rights Commission announced it has put the matter before the ACT Supreme Court. The Northern Territory is watching the developments in the ACT closely. Raytheon has many interests there. It runs Pine Gap and it has staff in Darwin too. Last year, Raytheon applied to the NT Anti-Discrimination Commission for permission to discriminate on the grounds of race, just as the Commissioner, Tony Fitzgerald, was about to announce his decision, Raytheon withdrew its application. Background Briefing was told that Raytheon withdrew because it wanted to focus on winning the battle in the ACT and might go back to the NT later, hoping by then every other jurisdiction will have fallen into line. That would leave the Northern Territory as the last to hold out. But Tony Fitzgerald's ready for them. He had his findings, so he made it public.
I had specific concerns in relation to the way the evidence had been presented, because what they were saying was that there were economic ramifications for Australia if the exemption wasn't granted. And then by implication, they were asking me to assume that those economic ramifications would simply transfer to the territory. And basically, they hadn't provided me with sufficient evidence to support that contention.
Tony Fitzgerald says his job is to balance competing public interests. But in the Northern Territory, the public interest in race is likely to be more important than jobs in defence.
I found, in relation to the NT, that there's a heightened public interest in matters of race and matters of protection against racial discrimination, and that it's likely to be higher in the Territory than other states because 44% of families in the Territory speak a language other than English at home. So my contention is that it's especially inappropriate in the NT, which is so race conscious, to approve an exemption application authorising racial distinction in employment. The primary consideration in recruitment should be ability to do the job.
But for America, the primary consideration in defence recruitment is your country of birth, your race. Anti-Discrimination Commissioner of the Northern Territory, Tony Fitzgerald, says if Raytheon reapplies, they'll have to give him a bit more detail to go on.
Hopefully they'll come back with some more cogent, comprehensive evidence in support of their application. You know, they've made assumptions about the defence contracts aren't fulfilled, then a national security will be affected. Well, they contended that that was the case but didn't support it. Now, maybe they'll come back with some specific information about national security, or maybe they'll come back with some more economic information about exactly how many employees they've got who are engaged in ITAR-controlled US materials. I mean, I received none of that. But I don't think it'll change the balancing exercise. I mean, it'll still be the exercise in considering an exemption will be a balance of these competing public interests.
Northern Territory Anti-Discrimination Commissioner Tony Fitzgerald. You're listening to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. I'm Lorena Allam. Today we're taking a look at the price Australia pays for being inside what the US calls its secure circle. That circle is growing ever tighter. The US fears terrorism and it also wants to protect its military advantage. And defence technology is big business. The US attempt to keep control over that technology might seem like overkill, until you read some of the 32 major cases it's busted just in the last year. And some of them were born Americans. A woman called Jerry Stringer conspired with her son, former US Air Force Sergeant Leonard Schenck, to steal restricted military night vision goggles, aviation helmets and other equipment from the Air Force and sell them to overseas buyers. Dawn and Darren Hanna allegedly received $9 million to supply telecommunications gear to Iraq. The US has caught people trying to sell surface-to-air missiles, submachine guns, military source codes and nuclear secrets. In Utah, two men were charged with attempting to sell fighter jet components over the internet. One of the elements in this global issue is the way people are now moving around the world to study or work or live. Speaking at the Lowy Institute in February, Michael Fullilove.
I think governments, like the Australian government, are enabling and licensing people to live transnational lives by liberalising their economies, by encouraging multiculturalism and dual citizenship and the like.
While travel can broaden the mind, at the same time, the new technologies might narrow it, says Michael Fullilove.
We have the internet, email, blogs, Skype, Facebook and satellite TV in your native tongue, all of which enable people to maintain the currency of their networks and to sort of synchronise their life with what's happening in the homeland.
It's a global phenomenon which is making countries nervous about the potential and the politics of these new communities of migrants or diasporas.
Host countries are becoming increasingly aware and often uncomfortable about the new communities in their midst. It's not just the Cuban Americans anymore. It's the Iranians of Los Angeles, or Tehrangeles, as people call it. The mayor of Beverly Hills these days is an Iranian American. Depending on your viewpoint, London is either Londongrad or Londonistan, a tabloid term to describe the presence of Muslims.
But while they might inspire intolerance, Michael Fullilove says these new diasporas aren't necessarily a security threat. These worldwide webs of migration, as he calls them, are less likely to be a security threat.
Certainly, migratory flows can be conduits for terrorists. And it's also true that diasporas have a long history of providing arms and funds and shelter to insurgents fighting in their homeland, like the Tamil diaspora and the Tigers, or for that matter, Irish Americans and the IRA. But on the question of al-Qaeda-style terrorism in the West, I'm persuaded by the analysis of Olivier Roy and others who argue that the radicalisation behind 9/11 and those kinds of attacks is not caused by diasporas, but to some extent anyway, it's related to the absence of diasporas. Most of the perpetrators in 9/11 and those other attacks were radically disconnected from the country of their origin or their parents' country of origin, as well as being disconnected from the country in which they live. They were socially atomised and alienated, and they had doubts about their faith and their identity and how to live as a good Muslim in the West, and that made them easy prey for fundamentalist imams. So I don't buy the argument at all that it is diasporas that are responsible for that kind of terrorism.
Michael Fullerlove, speaking at the Lowy Institute early this year. So while preventing terrorism may only be a small part of the ITAR regulations, and while they're not only about race, it is mostly about the US protecting its defence trade monopoly. And interestingly, this is where its secure circle is at its weakest. The biggest violations of ITAR and security regulations are the American companies themselves. These aren't government agencies, they're private companies increasingly involved in handling defence technology. And that means a lot of classified material is in the hands of civilians. That material is often intangible. It's not a physical object, but it could be a computer code or a piece of software or even a whispered trade secret. All the big defence companies have been caught out by ITAR, sometimes stealing from each other. In 2006, Boeing had to pay out an astonishing $615 million to resolve allegations that it stole trade secrets from its main rival, Lockheed Martin, in order to win rocket contracts worth billions of dollars. That whopping fine is the biggest ever imposed on a defence contractor in the US. This is how it was reported on National Public Radio in America.
The Boeing Company and the Justice Department have reached a tentative settlement to close two criminal cases. The agreement would get the aircraft maker back in the good graces of Washington and appears to set a record for penalties paid by a Pentagon contractor. NPR's Peter
Overby. In the public radio report, the Project on Government Oversight, or POGO, a watchdog group based in Washington, says the way the US does defence business means it only has itself to blame. Scott Amey.
The government has pretty much placed itself in a position where it has to continually buy goods and services from contractors that violate federal law and federal regulations. The government's created its own monster, and it can only blame itself.
Scott Amey, speaking on National Public Radio in the US. Boeing ended up in trouble over a violation in Australia too.
Australia's new airborne radar surveillance system is a step closer. The first of four Boeing 737s to be modified under the Defence Force's Wedgetail project.
In 1999, Australia forked out about $1 billion to buy six high-tech surveillance planes called the Wedgetail. Boeing won the bid to supply these spy planes to the Australian Air Force.
This is good work for Australian people, you know. We get experience, we get skills. That experience and skill sets allows the aerospace industry in Australia to provide that strategic depth, that strategic support that we need in the Royal Australian Air Force.
But in 2001, the US charged Boeing with violating US military secrets and said it should never have offered the technology to Australia in the first place. Part of Boeing's punishment was a US $4 million fine, and it had to appoint a compliance officer for 3 years to make sure it behaved itself.
The Wedgetail aircraft will be able to use powerful scanners to monitor Australia's coastline or control air and sea battles. The six planes are expected to be in service by 2008.
The Wedgetail aircraft are now 3 years overdue, and they're not expected to be finished before 2010. The delay has cost Boeing a fortune, and needless to say, the Australian government's not impressed. In June, the Defence Minister Joel Fitzgibbon declared the project was of high concern and that Boeing had to lift their game to get the aircraft finished. The US government has Australia by the scruff of the neck. If companies don't comply with ITAR regulations, the US will simply withhold the defence materials Australia needs. Australia shouldn't fight these regulations, but embrace them, says Professor of Law at West Point, Roland Trope. This is a reading from a paper he wrote early this year.
This is a zero-tolerance universe. The US government remains highly concerned that unauthorised access to and releases of sensitive technical data could seriously jeopardise its national security. And such concerns have intensified in response to recent security breaches by US defence contractors.
Professor Trobe accepts that US companies themselves will breach the regulations, but says Australia has to get tough too.
ITAR control follows across borders. ITAR continues to apply even after the relevant defence article leaves the shores of the United States or enters the mind of an Australian citizen. It would be beneficial for Australian policymakers to create a regime that mirrored the ITAR standard. This would facilitate understanding and trust, communication and negotiation, and finally a transfer of much-needed technology. The best way to facilitate Australian access to advanced US military technologies is to tighten its regulatory and contractual measures.
An extract from a paper by military lawyer Roland Trope. Australia has not put the money and skills into developing our own defence industry, so we have no choice but to buy American, says Hugh White.
The good news is that the US continues to produce a very good technology which is very effective and which therefore provides a very significant contribution to Australia's capacity to defend itself. The bad news is that we have to pay increasing amounts for that, we have to manage some of the problems that we've been talking about, but also it does raise questions for the kind of posture that Australia can develop and sustain in the future.
Hugh White warns the deal might suit us now, but it's going to cost us a lot more than we think in the long run.
As the equipment becomes more complicated, as our access to some elements of the technology become more and more restricted, we rely more and more on the United States to support and maintain the equipment whilst we're conducting operations. And that does limit our self-reliance to conduct military operations independently of the United States.
The F-35 Lightning II is a fifth-generation stealth advanced strike fighter.
Hugh White uses the example of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, the high-tech stealth aircraft the Australian government's thinking of buying to replace our old fighter planes. This is from a promotional video for the plane.
Beginning in 2010, newly assigned F-35 pilots and maintainers from the Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, United Kingdom...
Much of the high-tech wizardry used in the plane might not be available to Australian industry because it's US top secret. So, Hugh White says, even if we get the technology, we're going to need the Americans to help us fix it.
That's right. I mean, if you look at the current processes we're going through to select a replacement for the old F-18s and the F-111 aircraft, we're looking at the Joint Strike Fighter. It's an immensely sophisticated aircraft. And we may well find that once the Joint Strike Fighter has been delivered, there are kinds of tasks that need to be performed to upgrade it, to maintain it, even to sustain it in week-to-week operations, which won't be available to Australian industry. And that will mean that increasingly our capacity to sustain operations using those capabilities for more than a day or two or maybe a couple of weeks will be limited by the US willingness to provide us with access to the systems needed to keep the thing in the air and in combat.
Hugh White.
Hey, George. Welcome to Kirribilli House.
Thank you, sir.
G'day. How are you?
That's our former Prime Minister John Howard welcoming George Bush to his first APEC press conference in Sydney last year. The two leaders signed the US-Australia Defence Trade Treaty.
We have agreed to a number of new arrangements, including a treaty relating to exchanges in concerning defence equipment, which effectively will remove layers of bureaucracy for defence industries in Australia acquiring American technology, and will enter that market on the same basis as do companies coming from the United Kingdom.
The treaty is designed to streamline the process Australian companies have to go through to comply with US regulations. US President George Bush.
We did sign a treaty today that was important. It's the US-Australia Defence Trade Cooperation Treaty. I think John put it best. It helped cut through the bureaucracy so that we can transform our forces better, share technology better, and frankly enable our private sectors to work together to develop new defense capabilities to defend ourselves. And it was an important treaty. It took a while to get here, but it's we were able to get it done, and I thank you for giving me a chance to sign it here.
Okay, thank you.
From the Defense Department in Canberra, Kerry Clark says the treaty will make business so much easier.
Firstly, I think the treaty is a great step forward because it requires fewer licences to be given. The treaty will create an environment called an approved community. So you and I are checked out to be who we say we are and are actually capable and responsible people for dealing with this security equipment. You and I would then be in the approved community. You and I could then exchange information between each other without having to refer back to the US State Department.
But the treaty isn't in force yet, and it's unlikely to happen anytime soon. It has to get approval from the US Senate, and those hearings have been going on for months.
With the permission of the chairman, I've been asked to commence the hearing. The chairman will be with us
in May.
Just a few minutes.
The treaty got a hearing at the US Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. The chair of that committee is Democrat Senator Joe Biden. This is what he had to say, firstly, about ITAR.
You know, this has never been a very popular piece of legislation. Our allies and friends have found it difficult. And there's been many attempts over the years to amend it, to accommodate changes. But that also, as an old saying goes, the devil's in the details. And there's surely a lot of details in this treaty, at least I don't know enough about.
What Senator Biden wanted to know was how the treaty would control who gets hold of sensitive information.
We don't know. You don't lay it out, to best of my knowledge, what the mechanism will be. Someone comes now and says, I want to become part of the approved, what's the term of art?
Approved community.
The approved community. You know, I'm not questioning the integrity of our British and Australian allies, but there are middlemen involved here. And so why is there not, or are you going to provide for us the criteria you're going to look at? That's what I'm trying to get at here. How do we know?
In the Senate hearings, the Republicans also had their say, and they weren't happy either. Republican Senator Robert Lugar said he isn't being told enough to convince him to sign the treaty.
You've asked that we ratify these expeditiously, and I think the chairman and members of the committee are eager to do that, but it could become a mission impossible if we're not really able to get from you or the administration things we need.
And then, after hours of discussion of the devil in the details, Joe Biden had this to say.
By the way, I'm much less politic than my friend is. Until we work out the matter the Senator raised in the first time, there's going to be no treaty. It's not going to come out of this committee. So I thank you very, very much, and we are adjourned.
Thank you.
That's Senator Joe Biden, turning Australia down at the US Senate Foreign Relations Committee in May this year. 3 months later, it's still not settled. And that's not a surprise, says defence commentator Bob Wiley.
Now, what you've got at work there, this is a Democrat senator who is concerned about the prerogatives of the Senate and the Congress in treaty making in the United States. And if you look at the history of various attempts to change these defence trade laws and the ITAR, they have fallen foul of congressional interests for something over 12 years.
Bob Wiley, even if it's signed, it won't make much difference to the race discrimination on the factory floor. Simon Rice.
There is no mention in the current treaty of any change to the discrimination provisions. In fact, the current treaty confirms the continuing discrimination provisions.
So you don't think there's any interest here or in the US to resolve this matter?
No. So far, the tribunals unwillingly have, and perhaps unwittingly, have been doing the job for them. For as long as the tribunals keep granting exemptions, then why should the government bother complicating their negotiations with a little discrimination provision? It's being avoided in any event.
The nature of the dilemma needs to be put to the Australian people, says Bob Wiley.
The Americans don't care about the adjustments that we have to make. And in a sense, I mean, well, that's life. The ITAR and our attitude, that the Defence Trade Treaty that we've signed, says as much about us as it says about the United States. We get innovation on the cheap. And if we want to be more independent of the US in this area, then we have to be prepared to invest much more of our treasure, much more of our talent, and to take much larger risks than we've been prepared to take to date. And I think that's the way we should be portraying the debate, not or the American administration's evil and that ITAR is an instrument of the devil. It's a choice we make, and we need to acknowledge that that's very much a matter for Australian governments and the Australian citizenry.
Well, the Australian government is writing its defence agenda right now in the form of a white paper. A white paper is a major briefing for the government on the state of our defence forces and the possible strategic issues facing us in the future. There's a series of public hearings going on around the country until September. Defence white papers don't come round often. The last one was over 8 years ago. Hugh White was involved in the last one. The defence landscape, he says, has changed radically since then, and it's going to change more.
Well, I think the really deep question for Australia in this area is the extent to which we can expect to be able to continue to rely on US source technology as the foundation for our security, if, as is possible, the US becomes a less dominant power in Asia, and that therefore the nature of the Australia-US alliance starts to change. And if that's right, then building into our force structure this very deep reliance on the United States, not just to supply equipment, but to cooperate in the management and operation of that equipment, does carry some strategic risks. The dilemma is, if we don't buy such equipment from the United States, it's hard to see where we do buy it from. So there's no neat way out of this dilemma.
Hugh White says this government needs to make some tough decisions.
I think one of the core questions for Australian defence policy as the government looks at the new white paper is, to what extent does Australia try and build independent capabilities that give us independent strategic weight in Asia, which we might need if the US-Australia relationship changes shape and becomes less intimate in coming decades, then that has some very significant implications for the way in which we develop our capabilities and the kinds of dependence that we're prepared to accept on the United States. Now, whether or not the government's white paper process really will do that, whether they'll be prepared to go so far as to raise those very deep questions, or whether they'll rather produce a document which is a little bit more a description and defence of the status quo, will be up to the political courage of the Prime Minister and the Defence Minister.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. The researcher is Anna Whitfeld. Technical production this week is by Mark Don. The executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. I'm Lorena Allen, and this is ABC Radio National.
Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.